Hello, my name is Dave Emery. This is Side 1 of For the Record program number 519, titled More History of the Islamic Fascist Axis. This is being recorded on July 24th of the year 2005. At the end of this program, I'm going to make some references to a wealth of material now available on the web, both audio and print files. Thanks on this to many listeners, of course, to Al from Spitfire, to WFMU, and to a growing number of listeners who have contributed their considerable efforts to building the online Dave Emery/For the Record body of audio and printed information. Now, in this program, as indicated by the title, I'm going to explore more of the history of the Islamic fascist relationship. This partly by way of following up the landmark article in the Wall Street Journal of July 12th of this year that we read in its entirety last week. Also, I think in terms of understanding the contemporary political landscape, it is essential to understand not only that the Islamic fascist axis is very real, but also to understand how this evolved in time. One of the reasons is that very often, and this is not to pass judgment, very often one is identified as a bigot if one discusses this, and this in considerable measure is due to the fact that our media is, to say the least, very limited in its coverage of such matters, and also the fact that our educational system just doesn't do its job. To really understand the history, and we're going to go into this later in the program, one has to begin at the closing stages of the Ottoman Empire. And indeed, Americans don't even know what the Ottoman Empire is. You talk to the average American about the Ottoman Empire, they think you're talking about a retail furniture outlet. So we are going to flesh some of that history out, and that is by way of understanding the present. Now, many people have contacted me asking me what I thought about the London bombings. I have a lot of different thoughts about the London bombings, and I'm going to go into those in the future. However, I think that, as I said, in the wake of the Wall Street Journal article from last week, and with an understanding of how the Muslim-fascist relationship bears directly on what is taking place today, I want to go into a very, very good article from the web and sort of tie this in with some of the events that are taking place. There are a number of things that I will be exploring in conjunction with the London bombings. First of all, I'm going to review some information from For the Record Program 474 about the outing of Muhammad Noor Khan. That was a Pakistani al-Qaeda operative. He had been turned by British and Pakistani intelligence, or elements of Pakistani intelligence, and indeed was an in-place al-Qaeda double agent, a double agent for Western intelligence. And his identity was leaked as part of the Bush administration's campaign strategy to show themselves strong on the war on terror. And intelligence analysts have cited the outing of this turned operative as a faux pas in the world of intelligence. To what extent the outing of Muhammad Noor Khan may have facilitated the planning for some of the London attacks is one of the questions we will be exploring. In addition to that, we're going to be taking a look at an article from November 22nd of 2004 from Newsweek that talks also about the Bush administration's spinning of the war on terror, and specifically at the height of the presidential campaign and right after the Democratic convention, there was a code orange alert suggesting that al-Qaeda was planning imminent attacks on American financial centers. And in fact, it turns out that this was a deliberate skewing of the intelligence, and that the field-level intelligence that was coming out pointed in the direction of an attack in the United Kingdom. And these intelligence warnings were so pointed that FBI operatives on station in the United Kingdom as part of the counter-terror effort declined to ride the London subways, which is interesting, not definitive, but more than a little interesting. Those are a couple of the articles we're going to be exploring. We're also going to take a look at an article that I misplaced. I had downloaded this, but now I have misplaced it, concerning the head of the London transportation system. He is a former CIA officer. Whether or not that is relevant, I don't know. It is certainly interesting. It might be relevant. We will talk about that. We're also going to talk about some of the really terrifying things on the horizon. And one of the reasons that I think it's important to explore the Muslim-Islamist axis is that what we are witnessing is not only a continuation of the Second World War, with the Third Reich having gone underground, used us in part to help get rid of the former Soviet Union. Now it is our turn. Many of the analyses of September 11th and related events, understandably, by the way, this is not meant to be judgmental, deal with September 11th although as though it were a provocation. It was certainly used that way by some elements, but the thrust has basically been this is the onrushing march of, quote, U.S. imperialism, unquote. What is going on in this country, what the Bush administration is doing, is not how you do imperialism. This is how you destroy a society. And the Muslim peoples of what the Nazi geopoliticians called the Earth Island are going to be used as proxy, are being used, in my opinion, as proxy warriors against the United States, Israel, and the United Kingdom. And when one studies what the Bush administration is doing, this ain't how you do imperialism, folks. This is how you destroy a society. Some of the articles we're going to be talking about. UN alert as nuclear plans go missing from the Guardian of June 9th. Does that make you feel good? Stick around. We'll find out where that has gone. And in terms of if my analysis of the Bush administration as a fifth column that is actually going to destroy the United States, it's actually doing a pretty damn good job of destroying the United States now. Just consider the following. This is from the Financial Times. There have been other articles about this. Iraq and Iran to cooperate over defense. That's right. Now that we've liberated Iraq from Saddam Hussein, a monster certainly, a monster put in part by us, but now they are hooking up with the Iranians, and they're going to be cooperating on military matters as well. In addition, the Muslim Brotherhood is resurgent due to Bush's push for democracy. These are some of the things that we're going to be exploring. I cannot suggest too strongly that one wants to avoid oversimplifying these events. I have a lot of thoughts about the London bombing, some of which I will share in this broadcast. I caution against oversimplification. And many of the paradigms that are being kicked around, aside from more or less overtly fascist and anti-Semitic spins on September 11th, basically, you know, it was to choose, yeah? And, of course, you know, to choose run America. It is the Zionists in control of the United States, yeah? And there's a lot of that BS on the Internet. One of the things that is not properly understood is what has happened since the end of the Cold War. The racist right was, to a large extent, worldwide, was to a large extent acting in solidarity with the U.S. against the former Soviet Union. But with the demise of the former Soviet Union, they turned on the United States, and it is our turn now. And we are going to be destroyed if we can't turn it around. And I would emphatically encourage everyone in the listening audience to do everything possible to try to avert such a catastrophe. But those are some of the things that are in the offing. Now, I'm going to be talking about a few contemporary manifestations of the Islamic fascist axis. There are many broadcasts that have talked about this, including the description. I refer listeners to the programs 498 and 499 about SECO. That is a very important pair of programs. The many programs I've done about Al-Taqwa, some of the neo-Nazi links to September 11th, and other programs for background on this. There was a publication out of Europe, specifically France, called Occidentalis. I don't know what this publication is. It appears to be a conservative publication, not a fascist one, but a sort of middle conservative French publication. I would appreciate any information listeners can give me about this. But a listener sent me a well-researched and well-footnoted article from Occidentalis. It is dated December 13th of 2004. And the article is called The Reds, the Browns, and the Greens. This article talks about cooperation between the Islamo-fascist movement, traditional fascism, and residual communist elements in what might be termed a third position or a Yaqiite fascist construct here. We've talked about this some in the past. We will talk about that again in the future. For perhaps the best understanding of, quote, left, unquote, fascism, I refer people to the landmark text, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaqui and the Postwar Fascist International by Kevin Coogan. It's been my privilege to interview Kevin a number of times on these airwaves, and those broadcasts are available on the WFMU websites, and Kevin's book is available as well. It's a deep thoughtful treatment and very elaborately documented treatment of that and other subjects. A must read for anyone who wants to understand post-World War II fascism. But by way of sort of footnoting to a certain extent the London bombings and tying those in with some of the complexities that need to be understood to view those events clearly, we're going to turn to a section of this article, The Reds, the Browns, and the Greens from Occidentalis. The program will contain a URL for this publication. In past discussions of British neo-fascism, we've talked about a fellow who was born David Myatt. He became an occultist and was strongly associated with various Satanist groups, using various occult and satanic beliefs as a front for fascist action. Well, David Myatt, again, one of the most heinous figures in British neo-fascism, has undergone something of a transformation. He's no longer a satanic fascist. Now he is a Muslim. Skipping down in this article, the charismatic leader of the English neo-Nazi movement, David Myatt, has now become Abdul Aziz Ibn Myatt and appeals to those nostalgic Axis members and to all enemies of the Zionists to embrace with him the jihad, the true martial religion, unquote, which will most effectively fight against the Jews and the Americans. Another sign of this rapprochement, on April 3, 2003, the Salafist Londoner Omar Bakri Mohammed, leader of the movement Al-Muhajirun, as well as being imam of the Finsbury Park Mosque and a recruiter of a number of youths who went off to join Al-Qaeda, officially received David Myatt and accorded him a, quote, welcome into Islam, unquote, specifying to journalists that the neo-Nazi past of this neophyte had, quote, no special importance once their goals converged in common, unquote. Well, Mr. Mohammed was taken into custody in the wake of the London bombings, and his relationship with Myatt here in many ways illustrates and is emblematic of the fascist-Islamist alliance. And also, in terms of analyzing the complexities of the two waves of London bombings, one should bear this in mind. Another article, which I think is terribly important, we will be going into this at greater length in the future, and that concerns the fact that Yaslam bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's half-brother and the head of SECO, and I believe, for the record, so to speak, that SECO is the key to the September 11th investigation, he has now come forward and has stated that he would pay for Osama bin Laden's legal defense if Osama is ever captured. This article, researched for us by a listener from the Las Vegas Sun of July 3rd of 2005, article by Nadia Abu El-Magid of the Associated Press, datelined Cairo, Egypt, headlined, Bin Laden Relative to Pay for His Defense. One of Osama bin Laden's half-brothers said he would pay for the terror mastermind's defense should he ever be captured, Yaslam bin Laden said in a broadcast interview. For sure, Yaslam bin Laden responded when asked if he would help pay. Everyone has the right to defend himself. Anyone who was accused of doing something, unquote. And it goes on to discuss his belief that he is not dead. And again, Yaslam bin Laden is the head of SECO, and I believe that SECO is in many ways the key to the September 11th investigation. Due to limitations of time, we haven't got time to go into that here, but SECO unites many of the disparate elements that crop up in connection with the September 11th investigation, from Iran-Contra-connected drug smuggling networks to old-line fascists allied with François Genoux and the Old Guard from the Third Reich, to neo-fascists allied with Al-Qaeda and some of the American and British so-called neo-Nazis. And again, I believe SECO is the key, and it is terribly significant, in my opinion, that Yaslam bin Laden, who has previously maintained that he doesn't have any connections with or sympathy for his brother, has now come forward and said, yep, he will pay for his brother's defense if it ever comes to that. Very important article, another we are going to go into at great length. The father of Mohammed Atta, one of the September 11th hijackers and one of the keys to the investigation, witness Daniel Hopsicker's landmark research, he has now come forward not only endorsing the British bombings, but also stating that anybody who condemns the London bombings is a traitor to Islam. The most interesting thing about this story, however, is the fact that he is, again, this is Mohammed Atta's father. He's identified as Mohammed El Amir, an Egyptian. An Egyptian identified as Mohammed El Amir is the brother of Dr. Mahdi El Amir, a New Jersey-based Republican Al-Qaeda financier whose legal defense, when he came under criminal investigation by the state of New Jersey in the late 1990s, his legal defense was handled by none other than Michael Chertoff, who later went on to become a key Justice Department official, was in charge with Operation Green Quest, the investigation, or the alleged investigation, into terrorist financing. He helped to, Michael Chertoff, that is, helped to deep six that investigation. And Michael Chertoff is now the head of the Department of Homeland Security. And in For the Record programs numbers 495 and 500, we took a look at Operation Diamondback, its stingman, Randy Glass, and his discussions with Mohammed El Amir, who wanted to obtain weapons on behalf of Al-Qaeda. Whether this is the same Mohammed El Amir as is the father of Mohammed Atta, that is the $64,000 question. I would note that in Daniel Hopsicker's research, Mohammed Atta's father is identified as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Once again, illustrating the influence of Nazi and fascist philosophy on Islamism or Islamofascism, we're going to read a short section of an article from Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute, and this talks about an interview with Dr. Ahmed Dewidar, the Imam of the Islamic Society of Mid-Manhattan and a lecturer on Islamic studies at Manhattanville College. He's been referred to as, quote, the face of the next generation of Muslims in America, unquote, and is considered a prominent Muslim leader in New York and has met with, among others, President George W. Bush, Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and New York State Governor George Pataki. He's also met with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Dr. Dewidar is Egyptian-born. He attended the annual conference of the Supreme Council of Islamic Affairs in Egypt and gave a series of media interviews, including to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, that posted it on their website, www.iqanonline.com. Now, considering that this guy is something of a, considered a mainstream American Muslim, consider the views that he is expressing. Basically, unadulterated fascist views, and it is a fascism that has a European heritage. Skipping down in the interview, whether 9/11 was planned or pinned on Muslims, it provided an opportunity for the U.S. government to legislate dubious laws. Question, what steps did you take to fend off the accusation that stuck to the Muslims that they were behind September 11th? Dewidar, although a large part of American society believes that 9/11 was an operation planned and fabricated in order to forge a new reality of world rule under the so-called New World Order, most of society got the message from the Muslims that they were in fact the ones behind the attacks. This message was reflected in the fact that Taliban and Osama bin Laden took responsibility for the event, as well as in the reactions of glee in the Arab and Muslim world to what happened. As far as the American government is concerned, these events, whether or not these events were planned or pinned on the Muslims or something else, provided an opportunity for the American government to legislate dubious laws that restrict the growth and presence of Islam in the U.S., such as the anti-terrorism law and other laws. And this goes on to discuss in the following, but as far as American society is concerned, the suspicion towards anything Islamic in the streets, in places of recreation and commerce, and in workplaces remains a heavy burden on the Muslim citizen in America. And what Dr. Dewidar goes on to illustrate here, probably unconsciously, is why there are a lot of very right-thinking Americans, as well as people around the world, people of sincere anti-fascist sentiment, who view people like Dr. Dewidar with a jaundiced eye. Witness the following. Quote, the media, most of which is under Zionist control, has helped to spread this perception. When the media see a bearded Muslim selling fast food on any street in any state, they put the camera lens in front of him and interview him as though he represents Islam. At the same time, they ignore every moderate Islamic voice, every serious scientific Islamic model, and every expert religious scholar. We're trying to deal with this phenomenon through constant contact with the media and by registering complaints with its directors, unquote. The brutal irony here of his cavalier statements about most of the media being under Zionist control. Now, is he talking about AOL Time Warner, controlled by a consortium of Saudi princes? Bertelsmann, the publishing house of the SS and part of the Underground Reich, ABC Disney, ABC controlled by previously Cap Cities, controlled by the late William Casey, Disney, obviously named after the late Walt Disney, an associate of the American Nazi Party and a raving anti-Semite. Just what Zionist control of the media is Dr. Dewadar talking about? And the irony of what he's talking about here, the fact that he is expressing more or less overt fascist views here and views that have a Nazi heritage, is obviously lost on him and, frankly, an awful lot of other people as well. And then, skipping down here, we find, what is the extent of the Muslim community's influence on American society? Quote, the Zionist community numbers only 3 million, but they control the government, the politics, the economy, and the media in the U.S. At the same time, the Islamic community numbers 11 million, but its influence is weak. There are a number of reasons for this. The main ones are that the Muslim community is composed of different cultures, languages, and countries of origin. They are Arabs, Asians, Iranians, and others. And that the Islamic community is a society that only recently emigrated to the U.S. And goes on to talk about Jewish control of the media, skipping down again. Are the only obstacles that prevent the organization and influence of the Muslim community obstacles related to its internal affairs? Unquote. Dr. Dewadar. Of course not. Many are interested in preventing our influence in society. First and foremost, the Zionist lobby, which influences the media at present, so that we cannot spread our ideas and spotlight our leaders and our successful models. Even when a Muslim tries to work in the media, he has to contend with 5 million media employees who are controlled by the Jews. If he is a genius and they are forced to employ him, he works behind the camera, not in front of it. At the same time, we see rich Muslims buying up the Egyptian cinema heritage for $800 million and not working to set up an Islamic channel of a level sufficient to reach foreign societies scientifically and professionally. By the way, Egyptian State TV during Ramadan of 2002 showed a long made-for-TV drama based on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That, of course, a famed anti-Semitic forger originally put together by the Tsarist secret police around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Later, it was adopted by Hitler and became one of the linchpins of Nazi anti-Semitism. Now, with regard to such things as the conversion of David Myatt, a former Nazi Satanist, now a Nazi Islamist, to Islam, and his favorable reception by Mr. Bakri, who has been taken into custody in the wake of the London bombings, and in the pronouncements of Mr. Dewadar, not only deemed the future face of Islam in America, which is pretty depressing, but a man who, despite the honored treatment given him, is obviously about as venal a fascist as one could come up with, and yet one who takes for granted the preposterous leaps of faith, one sees contemporary developments of an historical trend that I think needs to be understood in order to evaluate the history of the Muslim fascist alliance. And we're going to go into that right now. We're going to cover as much of this paper here as we have time to. What we're going to go into now is an historical element. Specifically, we're going to take a look at some of the history of the origin of the Muslim fascist axis, because indeed that is very much with us. And in my opinion, we are not looking at, quote, U.S. imperialism, unquote. Certainly certain interests, particularly associated with the petroleum industry, are behaving in that fashion. What we are looking at is the setting of the stage for the annihilation of this country. And in particular, the Underground Reich is completing its agenda, in my opinion, and are using the Muslim populations of the Earth Island as proxy warriors. Now, note the role of competing empires in the last century in the development of the Islamic fascist axis. Specifically, note how in the closing days of the Ottoman Empire, the Husseini clan was very prominent in what was then known as Palestine. Note, too, how the British sought to co-opt that imperial cynicism and use the Husseinis to counterbalance the Nashashibis and the Hashemite clan in this part of the world. And note how this cynical manipulation of local populations for the purposes of maintaining the British Empire then dovetails with the growing imperial aspirations of Nazi Germany, and how this led to the growth of the Islamic fascist axis. Note also The alliance between Haj Amin al-Husseini and the Islamic fascists and various Muslim ethnic minorities in the former Soviet Union, because this was another of the factors that led to the growth of the Islamic fascist axis. And indeed, as we saw last week in the Cold War, these Muslim minorities within the former Soviet Union, many of which had an overtly fascist and SS history in the World War II period, were considered valued assets in the Cold War for their anti-communist sentiments. Chief among those were the Muslim Brotherhood, and it is the Muslim Brotherhood that spawned ultimately the Afghan Mujahideen of the 1980s, the MAK, and also Hamas and Al-Qaeda. Research coded on the following goes to a listener. This comes from globalpolitician.com. The full URL will be online. This is by David Storobin Esquire. It's called Nazi Influence on the Middle East During World War II. I'm specifically reading this as something of a follow-up to last week's Wall Street Journal article, and also setting some foundation for some of our future discussions of contemporary events. The end of World War I brought an end to the Ottoman colonization of Palestine. Towards the end of the war, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration supporting the, quote, establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, unquote. The original reaction of the Arabs was mixed. While many Arabs opposed the Zionists, Emir Faisal, who was the son of former Mecca ruler Sharif Hussein and later King of Iraq, signed in 1919 a declaration in support of the Balfour Declaration, even supporting all necessary measures, quote, to encourage and stimulate immigration of Jews into Palestine on a large scale, and as quickly as possible to settle Jewish immigrants upon the land through closer settlement and intense cultivation of the soil, unquote. But peace between Arab and Jew would not last. On April 4th, by the way, before I go into this, a little bit of the history of Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was actually an officer in the Turkish military during World War II. The Arab nations, or what were to become the Arab nations, were part of the Ottoman Empire. And Haj Amin al-Husseini was actually an officer in the Ottoman Turkish army during World War I and presided over the massacre of the Armenians in the Smyrna area. During World War I, the Turks engaged in genocide against the Christian Armenian minority. And Haj Amin al-Husseini got his feet wet, so to speak, with regard to genocide during World War I. And we're going to pick up with his activities in 1920 on the second side of the broadcast. A great deal of information available online. Websites maintained by WFMU that have the For the Records available on MP3 and streaming real audio. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. WFMU is podcasting the For the Record shows. A huge and growing website is maintained by Spitfire, which features Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, for download for free. Long article-length descriptions of each For the Record show, often featuring information I didn't have time to get in the original broadcast. They have a search function, a page to click on for people to support the work that I'm doing. And also, now, an enterprising listener has put together a blog sphere or blog spot of both the For the Record shows and the RFA shows as well. Also links to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest featuring the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. We will continue with this program in Side 2. This concludes Side 1 and For the Record program number 519, Further History of the Islamic Fascist Alliance. This is being recorded on July 24th of the year 2005. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.